The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 202.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a good buddy of mine, a superstar on FinTwit, and a bond expert, a strategist and consultant. His name is George Goncalves. George, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Great to be here, George. Thanks for having me.
Now, I always have a lot of equity guys on, but rarely do I have someone where their expertise is in bonds. And so I've got some questions for you right off the bat, some kind of basic
ones. Let's do it.
But the one that comes to mind first is, how much is the Fed controlling or manipulating or impacting, maybe is the best word, the yield curve on the short end and maybe more specifically on the long end?
I look, at this point, to be honest, the Fed is almost like let loose some of the reins. That's going to sound like crazy because they're buying $80 billion per month and they're doing $40 billion in mortgages, which also has a kind of an echoing effect because it's also the liquid kind of mortgage product that's tied to rates anyway. So they're basically doing somewhere between $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion-ish roughly per annum, which is a big large number of support from the bond market. But the issue is, you know, the deficits are basically dwarfing that number. And given what we still might not, you know in for another month or so, you know, the Biden administration wants to add another $1.9 trillion, and then maybe an infrastructure plan at the end of the year, which might be another trillion or two. So the right now, I think most forecasters, especially bond forecasters, are basically winging it, because you have to have like such large degrees of freedom of like what sort of supply is coming. So it could be anywhere like another $3 trillion, right? Meanwhile, you know, you look at the bond market, rates have been going up, but it's relatively pretty orderly, right? So I think the Fed has allowed this kind of natural churn basically, and rates have been grinding higher. And I think it's giving like a false sense of, you know, confidence that everything's kind of working out normally and that everything's on the up and up. And that's also impacting like, you know, value stocks, you know, commodities in general. You can always debate like, you know, yin and yang, who's driving who. But there is a strong correlation with the rates market. Like right now, everything, almost everything, if you pull up a chart of like commodities relative to the 10-year or, you know, the major ETFs like XLE, all the different energy sectors, they track the 10-year. If you look at even uranium, you look at any sort of commodity, it's tracking the 10-year. You look at like cyclical defensive type sectors in the equity market, like the sector rotation that's happening within equities, it's correlated with the 10-year. So in many ways, the Fed wants this. They want to see rates rise and give this sense that we're reflating.
So yeah, I think you touched on it there. Do you think that it's the 10-year going up because of commodity prices, therefore future inflation expectation? Or do you think the commodities are going up because the 10-year is going up? Which is it?
Well, you know, maybe we'll get into it a little bit later on too. But I do think that the move that we saw in TIPS breakevens, which is the other side of the overall treasury rate and the inflation expectations that are embedded within interest rates, they moved up, I would say, initially over the big impulse of Fed buying so many TIPS. They took their holdings from like 10% to 20% of the market in a matter of a couple of months last year. And they've been slowly adding to the TIPS market over time. And that has been kind of naturally lifting up inflation expectations, number one. In general, liquidity, when it enters into the market, TIPS and inflation like kind of hedges are really sensitive to excess liquidity. So when there's more liquidity in the system, these kind of inflation hedges pick up and they start getting higher in levels. And it has a correlation to oil. And then from there, it starts to like feed into the commodities market. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not one to say that it's all just about the bond market and that's therefore driving the story. Right. There is truly demand for commodities. I do think that, you know, we probably have seen a low and we're in this big bottoming process. The question is, if nothing ever goes vertical. And I think that, you know, a lot of it's priced in, or a good amount is priced in for the initial impulse.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, maybe even a more basic question is, where do you think the 10-year would be if the Fed just stopped buying, just stopped right now, we're going to say, okay, we've gone to church. We've found the truth. We want more of a free market. Maybe they don't sell. You know, let's not get too crazy. But they just stop their buying, just cold turkey tomorrow. Where do you think the 10-year goes?
Initially, it's going to be a knee-jerk reaction because all these things, markets like well-telegraphed, smooth transitions.
Right.
If you had something super draconian where they say, like, look, we need to stop because of XYZ, we can easily sell off 100 basis points or more. I mean, we can go, in essence, you would double or triple the level of rates of where they are now. I mean,
so the 2-3%.
Yeah, 2-3% would be within the remit if the Fed were just to kind of go cold turkey. They won't, so we know that that's really just a hypothetical. So
in other words, you think the Fed is manipulating the rate down by basically 100 or 200 basis points?
Yeah, the suppressing rates. I mean, all the work that I've done over the years, and you know, a lot of others have done the similar sort of studies, it ranges between 100 to 150. But given the magnitude of what they did this past year, it could be worth 200 basis points. Who knows, really? Because it's like, it's kind of like this, it's more art than it is science at this point. But easily 100 plus basis points lower than where they would be otherwise.
Yeah. So, I mean, in essence, don't we have yield curve control right now?
Aha. Uh-huh. So that's the thing, right? I mean, it's yield curve control with like a very arm's length kind of agreement. And it's really around that once you commit to yield curve control, it's really hard to get out of it. You end up then having to further wedge yourself to the Treasury like we saw during the 1940s, during the you know, during the whole relationship around World War II and coming out of the post-war period. You needed to have super low rates, and it had to be an agreement. And the Fed basically looked the other way. Way for inflation and just let, you know, just, you know, we had sometimes massive inflation, then we'd have big deflation. But on average, we had higher inflation over time during the early, late 40s into early 50s. And I don't think that they're there yet. And by the way, we always hear that they have a toolbox, right? That there's always more things that they can release. I don't think they want to characterize this yet as yield curve control because they are being flexible. And so if things, you know, do turn out better in the second half, will they taper? Will they slow down the QE? That's, you know, initially I thought maybe they would, but now that we're seeing so much more demands from the bond market coming from this administration, it's going to be hard for the Fed to step away. That said, I mean, if things are really rip-roaring and the economy is growing at 5, 6, 7%, even if it's temporary, the Fed might be in a really difficult situation about its independence, and it might want to back out. And at that point, then we're going to really see, you know, valuations for everything. Like, what is the true intrinsic value for the bond market, for the dollar, for, you know, stock markets and so forth. And they're nervous about that. And they're just trying to, you know, really, you know, keep their poker face and stay 1 month at a time.
Yeah. You know, to me, it seems like giving drugs to a drug addict. And we talked about this before where, you just, once you start with the drugs, once you become addicted to that, whether it's alcohol, heroin, whatever it is, you know, you just need more and more and more just to sustain a certain level. And it seems like we're doing the exact same thing with QE. You know, initially, and I think Schiff made this point the other day, and it's, if you think about it, it makes so much sense that when Bernanke came out with QE, it wasn't called QE1. Because we weren't supposed to have 2 and 3. It was just called QE. It was extreme circumstances. And then that turns into 2 and 3. And then we got the repo spike. And that turns into not QE. And then QE4. And then QE infinity. And now, you know, I was listening to Druckenmiller with Goldman Sachs the other day on that interview he did. And he mentioned that they did as much QE, or buying of treasuries more specifically, in like a 3 month span from March to May 2020, as they did in the 10 years prior with Bernanke and Yellen. So it's almost like we're at a point right now where it's not that we have to take more drugs to sustain a certain level. We have to take exponentially more drugs to sustain that level. Do you think I'm I'm right there. Or...
Here's the thing. It's all about your point you're basically making is like, what is the encore? Like, what's the next, like, what can they do next to keep this going, right? Because if you do 1 trillion QE and then your encore was 3 trillion, does it have to be 6 trillion to actually keep things stable?
Yeah, right.
But the problem is, and they're quickly starting to realize this, and I think this is going to happen. This is why I put out the idea that there's a risk for some tapering. They still do QE through the conventional banking system, and this is something that I know that you followed Richard Werner, Princess of the Yen, and even and I've studied a lot of the other central banks' activities around the world as well. Once they become so deep with the banking system and they really need them to get that liquidity into the system, there's a saturation point potentially. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But we in QE3, we got close to 30% of reserves to the deposit ratios. And that's when the Fed started to like say, hey, maybe we're going to taper. And then, of course, they it was not a well thought out communication policy. And we saw what happened to credit.
Let's pause right there because that's super, super crucial. And I want to make sure people really are following what you're saying right there. So first and foremost, we're saying that the Fed can the only thing they can really do, although they say they have a lot of tools, but they really have one, and that's create bank reserves.
Correct.
So they can create, you know, quadrillion bank reserves, but they have to rely, or usually they have to rely on the commercial banking system to do something with those reserves, to use those reserves as a backstop, let's say, to create more loans in the real economy, which creates more currency units, more dollars, which creates more M2 money supply. So it's the difference between base money and broad money. And what you're saying with that last stat, if I heard you correctly, is the Fed monitors how much base money has increased relative to deposits, or how much base money has increased relative to broad money. And if broad money starts to increase, let's just say at the same level or whatever their metric is, then they say, okay, we need to put on the brakes because we see broad money really increasing. Therefore, we might have some future inflation expectations. Am I hearing you correctly?
It works in both directions. Yes. If banks all of a sudden like find that, you know, that they're animal spirits again, and also there's like a lot of demand and the economy is booming.
Right.
And we start to see rampant lending. Then, yeah, it works from that direction, too. I'm more thinking about it from the saturation point where they're inundating the banking system with these inert reserves.
OK.
And you get to a point where, yes, you know, they're paying very minuscule interest on reserves. And some foreign banks can arbitrage that through the Fed funds market and things like that. But it's not productive use of all this excess cash. It's sitting at the banks. If they don't do anything with it, it ends up, you know, being a deposit for somebody else, because the QEs, we've all been discussing this for the last year and a half, and partly because what they did and people forgot the first QEs and how they operated, it still gets stuck in the banking system, right? And so it only matters when the Fed buys an asset from a non-bank entity, from a portfolio manager, from an insurance company. They don't want to get reserves. They want to get cold, hard deposits, which is like electronic cash. So deposits go up and reserves go up. But if that ratio gets to a point where it's too big, in my humble opinion, and a few people have share this view, not too many. I don't know what that limitation is. Is it 50%? Like if half the banking system is reserves, is that really a viable solution for the banking system? Yeah. So I think the Fed and all central banks around the world have this, because even the Bank of Japan, from my calculations, they've never gone beyond 30%. The Swiss National Bank, similar situation. So I feel like this 35, basically a third of the banking system can probably warehouse central bank activity. At some point, they might be too much. And at that point is when things like central bank digital currency, or they have to funnel the money through the fiscal authority so that it actually gets into the economy and becomes circulating actually, either through electronic cash or actual paper cash.
Yeah, right.
Because that, for example, Japan, there's still a lot of cash notes for a country that's done QE for the last 20 plus years. There's still a lot of use of paper cash.
Mm.
So it still filters back into the real economy in a way that allows them to keep doing this QE thing slowly every time they need it, But if you get into this kind of vicious cycle where you have to always up the ante and do like double, triple, at some point, I think the QE game stops.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, but see, generally it's a relationship between the Fed and the commercial banking system, as far as broad money. But now all of a sudden we've inserted the government because the Fed is monetizing so much of the government debt. And if the Fed monetizes the debt, then once the government spends the money into the real economy via the TGA, now all of a sudden you're increasing broad money, when if the government would tax it, then spend it, they're kind of recirculating those dollars, if you want to think about it that way.
So that's true.
It isn't necessarily increasing broad money. So it's a completely different dynamic. You know, one thing I'd love to get your opinion on, I listened to a fantastic interview the other day on Macro Voices with my good buddy Eric Townsend and Russell Napier, where he was talking about his, he's kind of an inflationist now, and he sees that coming down the road in the future. And he was saying how he's trying to use some game theory here. And what he sees potentially happening is the way the government is going to not only control the yield curve through yield curve control, but they're also going to try to control inflation is by taking a lot of the money creation away from the commercial banking system. And therefore, he sees kind of this environment, if I was understanding him correctly, he sees this environment where the government is spending money into existence, like MMT, basically. But they're taking control away of some of the money creation, or all of the money creation, from the commercial banking system. Therefore, that's not a variable anymore. And the right. Central planners think that they can maybe fine tune it a little bit better. And then he also sees potentially price controls and a lot more micromanagement. But what do you think about that concept of maybe some of the money creation being more direct from the government into the real economy, as opposed to from the Fed through the commercial banking system into the real economy?
Look, I'm not against that view. The thing with me and what I've been trying to figure out for the last 10, 20 years is the sequence of events.
Right.
And so they're going to end up probably having to resort to that option, but that's like a later stage option.
Yeah. Okay.
And quite frankly, look, the CARES Act and what we're seeing now with fiscal, one-off, government transfers, that's kind of akin to the MMT concept that's out there. Right. And so we're seeing a version of that, but we're being told that it's temporary. It's not permanent. Right. And so because when you do this for 1 year, then the following year, you're going to have a cliff. You always have this kind of fiscal cliff. And so then you can't really, your expectations don't change enough to say, oh, I'm going to have a permanent stream of this new, money or whatever you want to call it. And then that I'm concerned that everyone else has this stream and they're going to start bidding up everything. And then, your food prices go up. What we're seeing now is like an early glimpse of that sort of world. But I think that they're trying to avoid jumping to that stage. And that's why they're still using the traditional mechanisms, and they're going to rely on the Fed to do a lot of heavy lifting. And they're going to do this fiscal. We'll see what kind of fiscal stimulus we get.
When we talk about heavy lifting, just to be clear, that means that the Fed is buying those treasuries pretty much directly from the treasury auction through the primary dealer banks and kind of that shell game they have. But they're basically monetizing the debt.
I mean, look, they're monetizing the debt through the secondary markets in that regard. But they're still not buying one for one, right? Like last year, they were buying more than what was being issued.
Right.
And now, like, given what the sort of debt load that's coming, by the middle of the year, the Fed should be behind the curve, and there's going to be more treasuries that the public sector has to, the private sector, you want to call it, not the public sector, but actual, individuals and corporations and investors have to start to buy those treasuries by the middle of the year. If at that point the Fed says we're not just buying $80 billion a month, we're going to have to buy 120 or 160, whatever the number is to make the math work out, then we know that fiscal dominance has been permanently established. It's not just a temporary, we're getting through this difficult period of the pandemic, right? If they up the ante in the middle of the year and the economy is like doing well, like you're going to be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Let just like market forces take over. And at some point, the stimulus has to end from the government, and then things will clear in 2022. If they change that midstream this year, then I'm wrong, And then, yeah, there's no real technical limit, because then the fiscal authorities can then be the way that the money gets into the real economy.
Right.
So I just feel like there's a step in between. Like, I think, like, yeah, they'll try it, and then if it fails, then they go to the more nuclear option.
Yeah. So do you think the yield curve is steepening right now because of inflation expectations, or because the market is front running this this event in the middle of 2021, where the government is going to be issuing more treasuries than the Fed is buying? Therefore, the private sector is going to have to soak up some of those treasuries. We'll see what the demand is. If the demand's not there, then rates go up. So yep. What do you think there? Do you think the yield curve is front running that, or is we're really seeing future inflation expectations?
I think we'll see a combination of two. Maybe I sent you a few charts. Maybe you can maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So walk us through this.
The five-year, I mean, maybe you know it. It's just like the forward five-year inflation expectation. Like okay, people think in 5 years' time. And then the five-year, which is the blue one, is the current five-year inflation that you expect to get for the next 5 years. And you can see it's a pretty sharp move. I mean, it basically, from March of last year, it's gone up over 200 basis points, which over 2%, basically, right? Mm. So a lot of like this is priced in. Now, the challenge or the argument for the opposite view is that in 2008, we didn't have this sort of government/Fed cooperation, right? So we don't know how high inflation expectations may get, but they've moved a ton a lot. So, and the reason why I show this chart relative to the forward one, it's a little wonky, so I'm just explaining. The little graph in the bottom is the spread between those two blue and orange line.
Oh, the gray is the spread between the between orange and blue.
Yeah. And it's pretty extreme. I mean, like, you need to start to price the reason, like, the five-year forward is for the gold people. If the gold people are right, and if we're going to get permanently higher inflation, then the whole long-term interest rates have to move faster than short-term interest rates. You know what I mean? Like, so like right now, everyone's like, oh yeah, for the next 5 years, maybe two or three of those 5 years, we're going to get a lot of inflation, but then it's going to peter off because the government can't keep this going forever. Mm. That's what that spread is telling you. Like, it's like the first 5 years of a 10-year window is going to be higher inflation. We'll see. It's debatable, but that's the pricing right now.
Okay.
And the orange. Okay. So now that you know that, then at least I can explain it quickly and not have to. All right, cool. I'll start from So George, to your point about, you know, what is the curve really embedding or trying to expect?
Yeah,
I think it's definitely a combination of more supply coming. We could discuss that later, but the inflation piece of it is playing a big role, and it's, and like as we mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, the inflation move higher initially was because they got so cheap, these tips and inflation expectations and hedges were so cheap during March, April, May, and June, that all this Fed liquidity and all the Fed buying of these tips as well helped lift them off the floor. And as you can see from this chart, the blue line, if you go into like, you know, February 20 or March 20 of last year,
yep,
got close to almost zero. Like, basically the market was expecting like no inflation for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And it's jumped over 200 basis points, roughly 2% more of inflation in a matter of the last year. That's a pretty fast move for the TIPS market. And then I compare it against this orange line, which is the inflation in 5 years' time for the next 5 years. So we call it the five-year, which is almost like a 10-year interest rate. That inflation expectation is not running as fast as the current inflation, which is telling you that the market thinks, okay, fine, fiscal authorities, Fed can maybe generate inflation in the short run, but it's not sustainable. And so this is why, if we can see this spread start to close a little bit, and actually all inflation expectations start moving towards, you know, 2.5 or 3%, right now it's around 2.4, then the gold people, those that are worried about currency debasement, whatever sort of concerns about what inflation does to your hard-earned money, then they have a legitimate case, because then the actual bond market, which is one of the biggest markets out there, is equally concerned that this is not just a temporary fluke, it's a permanent inflationary shift in regime. Then that changes the equation for everything.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So you probably already explained this, but I'm seeing that the gray line is now down at basically zero, and it looks like the blue line has crossed the orange line, which seems rare. It seems like generally this blue line is underneath the orange line. So what is that telling us? Is that telling us just kind of what you just went over, or is that something different?
No, that's exactly what it's telling you. It's basically saying that people are more concerned about short-term inflation for the next couple of years.
Okay, got it.
And that's what the five-year blue one is capturing. It's the what we call the spot rate. And then the forward rate is the five-year forward break-even inflation expectations. That's the orange line. It's not going up as fast because the market's saying, okay, maybe the first 5 years you get inflation, but for the latter half of those 5 years or the 10-year window, the second five are going to be lower because there's still deflationary forces out there in the economy.
Huh. Boy, that's interesting when you take that back to 2005, 2006. I'm just saying the exact same thing. And I don't know if this forecast the GFC, but right, was they forecasted or not, they got that right. That's
for sure. 100%. I mean, the bond market, I mean, is at least, well, now everything moves so much faster because of information. People have gotten smarter. People are listening to your videos. And they're starting to understand these, you know, these relationships, right?
Yeah.
And you can start to get a better grasp of it. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the bond market was like, well, you know, the housing market is not sustainable. And at some point, it's going to cause a deflationary downdraft. And it did.
So that's what it was telling us back in 2005, 2006. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating to go back and think that through with the benefit of hindsight. All right. Awesome. So what's the next chart we should go to?
Yeah. Well, maybe just move to the next one. Another orange line and another blue line.
Yeah. Okay. Got now, it. Speed of the 5-year index inflation.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is looking at the speed of the inflation. So basically it's a zoomed in version of the chart we just went through.
Okay.
Just to make the point that this move is much faster than what was coming out of the financial crisis. So coming out of the financial crisis, which is the blue line of 2008, 2010, inflation expectations also had a big impulse higher, got above 2%, but much later than when what we just did. So we went from the COVID lows last year in March of 2020 to the most recent print as of today, or February 12th, I should say. That is a big, fast move. And I'm a big believer in bond markets in general. For those that are listening or involved, bond markets are much more mean reverting than any other asset class. It stretches too far, and then it kind of finds a resting place.
Right.
I think, this is my own personal view, that in the next 3 or 6 weeks, given what has been happening in other asset classes, that we're probably due a retracement. I could be wrong, and we keep powering through to higher rates and more inflation because it's becoming such a big topic. But I do think risk markets are stretched. There's so much euphoria in the system right now. It won't take much to see like a 5-10% correction in the equity market, and the bond market will still receive some of those flows.
Yeah. You know what's coming to my mind as I look at this chart, and you say that last time the trajectory just wasn't as extreme as it was in 2020 or how it's been recently. It just seems like it's almost matching the Fed's balance sheet, right? when the Fed started QE, it was just kind of this gradual move up to the point where we got to a max at like 4.5 trillion. But if you look at their balance sheet in 2020, it goes parabolic. And it seems like maybe those inflation expectations are matching the Fed's balance sheet as far as the angle that it's increasing.
Oh, sure. And they're, I mean, and similar by design, the M2 growth, right? It's all related, as you know. So yeah, no, it's different this time. So I don't want to like just use the parallels of the financial crisis, because I know it's ingrained in a lot of, it's like etched in a lot of our memories, considering how much volatility that it created and panic. But that's not the point. The point is, that was a pretty sharp move back then. This was an equally sharp, if not sharper, as we can see. The question is it sustainable? What keeps the fire burning? Right. And the fire burning is going to need like real inflation. And we just got CPI, and it was okay. We need to get services back up and running. We need to get the economy open again. And then you'll see that, you know, even if it's temporary, you're going to see inflation over the course of the summer. And then that's where we get this potential for like a false sense of security or a false dawn that we think, oh, we're out of the woods. Everything's great. The Fed's got our back. We got all this money coming in. It's inflation. That's probably when we probably peak out in most asset classes, in my view. And then it gets tricky from there.
Yeah, right. Are you someone that believes in this theory of all this pent-up demand? Because I've heard both arguments. You know, there's all this pent-up demand. People are locked up in their houses. And you're the other argument that's, okay, yeah, there's pent-up demand, but how many steak dinners can you actually make up for? So have you given that some thought?
Oh, no, completely. I think this is the crux of, I mean, everything's a transition right now. We don't know if Fed policy to fiscal policy is going to be perfectly handed off, or if they're going to do that experiment, or they're going to take a break. There's also the idea of, is this reflation trade, which we've heard it for the last decade. Oh, it's coming, and we're going to get another reflation trade, and then it falls flat on its face. Like, if this is truly the one, you know, it's up against the other side of the economy, which is in permanent suspended animation, right? So we're in this weird suspended animation around forbearance. Like, what really is the housing market doing? What is the renter's market doing? People have bills to pay. So pent up demand, and we have a lot of excess cash that built up because of these government fiscal transfers. Are they going to take that money and save a little bit, pay some of their debts off, pay back some of their bills that they are behind? Like, this idea of pent up demand, it's all going to come in like one for one. I don't buy that.
All right.
That's why they have to keep kind of coming back with more fiscal stimulus, because they know there's a cliff, and jobs won't come back that quickly either. So if we're in the, you know, we're going to have job growth. Don't get me wrong. I still think this is still it's going to be a confusing period, because it's going to look like everything's reopening again. But we never resolved the problems of the past, the high leverage and all the other issues that, you know, we've all covered in one degree or another. It's going to look good. It's going to feel good. And everyone loves, you know, to be hopeful for the future. But they're going to have these bills to pay, and therefore pent up demand won't be the same, in my opinion, for what's being. And by the way, people have been stuck at home. Fine. They've bought a lot of goods and items to keep themselves entertained while they're at home. So there's been a decent amount of activity just for those that could afford to do it. So I don't know. I don't buy extremes. And I think that people are hoping for this massive rip roaring economy. And it's going to feel like that for a couple of months, and then it's going to peter out.
Yeah, but I think there's a difference between inflation and a rip-roaring economy. And I know a lot of people that I hear on CNBC and Bloomberg, you know, they talk about inflation and economic growth as if they're synonymous.
Synonymous, I know.
And one and the same, where I don't know if they, you know, I never have taken an econ class in my life, so, or a finance class, anything like that. I almost flunked out of high school. So I don't know if they're teaching this in the textbook, but it seems as though they're kind of missing that whole inflation or consumer prices going up for the simple fact that there's more money chasing a smaller amount of goods and services. And that's another curveball to make matters even more complex. Is you've got this demand issue that we're just kind of floating in limbo, but then also you've got the supply side of the equation, and then, how much supply have we taken offline permanently, and you know, how is that going to look? You look at lumber prices have gone up 4x because of all of these weird kind of, it's not just with COVID, but some things with the trade deal that happened, that was kind of this perfect storm. But lumber prices have remained extremely high, where generally you'd have supply come back online to bring those prices down. It's like this hall of mirrors where there's just no price discovery. There's no price signals. So it's almost impossible to try to figure out the probabilities.
Oh, and by the way, we use options usually to figure out probabilities, and options markets are going bananas. So yeah. we can't even calibrate off of like just financial math now. We have
got to figure out what's going on Reddit first before, and then kind of layer that over your models for the options markets, right?
Yeah. So to your first point about financial literacy and just overall, you know, what we're hearing from, you know, major outlets. There's a lot of narrative and there's biases in every place, as we know, right? So yeah. I think that there's a need for those kind of interactions and the need to kind of get the general sound bites out there. But the deep hardcore analysis, you need to like look underneath the hood and really think through, you know, and go through the smell test. Does it actually make sense that this is how the economy works? And I think people are educating themselves. They're figuring out what works for them. And the economy is a collection of millions of people with their own opinions on how things work anyway.
Right.
And we're coming at it from different degrees and changing our habits. And, you know, maybe this, we're going to see a bigger increase of savers because, you know, that's what happened coming out of the 1930s and 40s. So we just don't know, right? This idea that everything's going to work perfectly, like they say, it's not even textbook. It's about managing to the narrative.
Yeah, right.
But like I said, the narrative right now is in flux. We have suspended animation, trying to reopen economies and think that it's going to lead to reflation. We don't know how that interacts.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been talking about stagflation and I've been of the opinion that that's most likely. And I totally get the deflationist argument and I respect that. And I think we could definitely see that short term, especially in asset prices, maybe not in groceries, but in a lot of other things. But I've been like, you know, I'm kind of like 40-60 leaning on the stagflation side. Going back, I mean, I've been talking about this for even before the whole COVID issue. So, but now, you know, it seems like every single podcast I listen to, everyone seems to be on the inflation side of the boat. And although I still have that opinion, I get worried that maybe I need to rethink that, because whenever I hear everyone agreeing with me, not that they know my opinion, but, you know, having the same opinion as I do, I sure. get kind of concerned.
Look, I'm a skeptical by nature, too, and I don't like to have the consensus completely come on board with the same idea, because then you start to think either A, it's priced in, or maybe we're all royally wrong.
Yeah.
And there might be a bigger problem. Having said that, it's okay sometimes for markets to kind of get on the same page, because there probably is a legitimate concern this time more than any other time in the last 10, 15 years of the risk for inflation or morphing into stagflation. Now it's again, it's now or never. Like, I mean, you need to keep doing it. So if you are of the view that, okay, fine, they're going to do it, maybe fail and then do it even bigger again, eventually something sticks, because they're not going to let the system fall apart. We all know that, right? It's not, I mean, I'm not like looking for an apocalyptic kind of outcome. It's more about how do you write the course while you're living through it. And they don't want to take the tough decisions, right? And
yeah.
So, I mean, could they one day just, I mean, I think Luke Rahman has mentioned this a number of times, where you could just change the decimal place on the gold that the U.S. owns and
yeah.
go from, you know, it being struck at the existing value of $35 all the way up to $10,000. Why not? Because at the end of the day, like, I'm a big believer, I know you are too, that you cannot just print your way to success. It's got to be built on productivity. And I'm actually producing things that people want, not just, you know, just supporting zombie companies either, right? So,
right.
But we're going through that right now. We basically have everything. We're like a mismatch of all macroeconomics and micro. It's all happening at once. It's like these weird like vortex movies that you see, like we're going through time or something.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it's so hard to even think through and figure out the probabilities is because we're not dealing with an economic question anymore. We're dealing with a political question.
That's right.
And I mean, the politicians are so insane, and who knows what drives them? I mean, and they're so dysfunctional. I mean, how on earth can you try to figure out what their next move is? I mean, you would assume that they would just continue to spend money like drunken sailors. That's what I think will happen. But I mean, who the heck knows now?
Who knows? Look, the hopeful side of me, because I'm like, I try to like lean like, you know, that there's obviously multiple paths out there. It's not just the worst case. And maybe this is why they're floating. And this is why, like, I mean, the crypto people are going to get upset if I say this, but there's, you know, the crypto market is out there as a proof of concept, in my opinion. I mean, they're trying to figure out, like, if we need to restructure the system and we're going to need to see new actors jump into the financial system and really lean on more checks and balances, blockchain type technology, and you're going to need to have pipes and the grease of the wheels might be these coins. I don't know. But the central banks won't let that happen without them being involved either, by the way. We all know that.
Yeah,
so
right.
Maybe this is all just proof of concept, and we're in the midst of the reset. We just don't know it because, you know, we're living through it day to day. I just feel like that, you know, that yes, the first kind of port of call is like you do what you've been doing always because it's easier. And like, okay, you just print more money, do more sort of spending, and you hope that it triggers something. And we have the Japan experience to show us that it doesn't work that way. The U.S. has been fortunate, really, in my humble opinion, because we still have a lot of animal spirits. If you look at like Europe, you look at Japan, they've done like orders of magnitudes equally or more in terms of QE, but their companies, you know, either don't have the compensation incentives, either, and you could debate if that's good or bad, but the U.S. is still at its core, still has, you know, vitality about wanting to build and create new things. That's why we have, you know, tech leaders and things like that. So in a way, if they can do this without completely, you know, creating stagflation and then ruining our vitality, then we might still come out on top. And like, but that's the part where you cannot rely on the politicians to figure this out. It has to be a consortium between public and private. Maybe we get it right in the next 5, 10 years. I don't know, but it's definitely nerve-wracking.
Yeah. My concern is what happens to animal spirits, because that's a key component of any type of restructuring of the economy, especially if you look at things through the lens of a Keynesian economist. And I just, everything that comes out in the news, it's just, I think to myself, okay, what is that doing to animal spirits? As an example, you know, you see a new regulation, or you see what's going on with California, or you see increase in taxes. You see California trying to not only create a wealth tax, but make that retroactive 10 years. You hear Canada talking about an excess profits tax. And you're like, okay. And even something, you know, we don't have to get into too extensively, but what we talked about prior to recording, now we're in this cancel culture. And it's like, okay, well, I, you know, most people don't think that's an economic issue. But is it? Because is this detracting from animal spirits? All these little things that, you know, that you just, you don't think too much of on their own, but when you combine them together, they're really meaningful, right? If you're an entrepreneur and you've got $1 million saved up and you're putting it into a starting a business that could fail, the chances are it's going to fail. And this is your life savings. And you're in charge of supporting your wife and your kids, or your husband and your kids, or whatever it is. And do you really want to put that at risk when you're living in California, as an example, and you're paying a 50-60% tax rate when you combine state and federal, and who knows what the wealth tax is going to be? Basically, you've got a target on your back. And then anything that you say that isn't politically correct, you know, who knows what they'll do in the future? Just shut you down or won't allow you to be on Facebook? Or, I mean, that, I don't see how that helps animal spirits. I guess that's my point.
Now, look, I mean, look, this is a topic that like goes into the whole social political spectrum that can go on for hours. I'll put it this way. I agree with you. It adds frictions.
Yeah.
And we don't know the cost of those frictions until maybe it's too late. The internal optimist in me is that because we are still at our core, I mean, we could debate how much the core is being whittled away. there's still an animal spirit fire that's burning in the U.S., more so than it is in Europe. There's a lot of in Southeast Asia, in South America, they have that as well, because they want to innovate and grow and get out of, like, into a better place. If we can still stay to that, some of these policies, if they are enacted, I don't know, we'll see. And if they prove to fail, and they probably would, it almost just then exposes that the other side was wrong to go that way. So it's almost like, again, it's a rite of passage. You have to go through the pain to realize that, to get back to the middle, to the center. And then that can hopefully fix a lot of the populism issues and everything else in the country as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, I know we're running short on time, buddy.
Tenure rates, because we haven't gone into the specifics on it, if you want to.
Okay, got it.
So, I mean, kind of thinking through, like, what all this means, because at the end of the day, we could debate what the price discovery mechanism that's left within the bond market. I still think there's a lot left in it, because the Fed's not buying. They bought a lot of the flow, but they haven't bought the whole market. There's still a lot of actors that are in there trying to figure out what value is. And they're also thinking about the future prospects of the nation and growth and inflation. Mm-hmm. And so one chart that I'm showing you here is looking at the 10-year versus the Fed funds rate, and it's looking at a regression line, which are these green, gray. The red is the kind of the mean of where rates are over a long period of time.
Okay, got it.
And so, like, there's, like, positive. You either are away from the mean, like, positive or negative.
Mm-hmm.
So you have either higher standard deviation or lower standard deviation measured as Z-scores. And that's what this is, a regression. We call them regression bands, basically. And it's been a pretty good predictor of how rates are going to behave over the last, basically, almost 30, 40 years. Now, a lot of people argue, like, well, that's all history. And that's true, but it's worked very well. So I'm not ready yet to give up on what this chart is telling us. I know others, like Raoul Powell, also look at charts similar to this as well.
Yeah.
It has been a strong magnetic force driving rates lower. And it is, again, the Fed has the tools of reserves. And by doing the reserves and buying QE or lowering rates, it's all about trying to stimulate through the interest rate channel. So this is, like, their main tool, right? So you can see what I've overlaid is the orange line, which is the Fed funds rate. And there's a lot of content in this chart that we can't go through in detail. The bottom line for me is that the mean is the red line. And you can see, if you zoom in where we are, February 21, we're basically back at the mean.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop the market from selling off more. And we discussed earlier about how steep the curves can get, how higher inflation will go, and how much additional term premium or compensation investors are going to want because the government's spending in droves. There is a limitation, in my humble opinion, until this channel's properly broken, and it hasn't been broken for over 40 years. And Japan has a similar one, and then it went sideways. It went all the way down, and then it stopped moving. So,
I mean, this is telling us that our max upside currently is maybe
two and a quarter, two and a half.
Oh, two and a half. Okay. Yeah. And then if it gets that high, it's most likely going to come back down again to 1.5. And then at some point in time, it's probably going to go back down to zero.
Yes. Yeah. And this is where, to kind of circle things back to the start of the conversation about sequence, we might get this final big blow off move in inflation, and then it goes into stagflation. But we probably still have one more date with deflation.
You're right.
And this is what this chart tries to capture, that the Fed's not hiking rates. And as you can tell, I circled these little purple circles where the orange overlaps with the blue interest rates.
Yeah, yeah.
The 10-year really only goes super high in the band when the Fed is hiking rates. And they're not going to be hiking rates anytime soon. So to get towards, like, 2.5-3% just on supply concerns and inflation concerns, that would be a clear sign that the regime has completely shifted. It's possible. I just think it's not probable at this point. And it probably will take that $6 trillion QE. It probably will take another, whatever, $5, $10 trillion of stimulus to do that. Maybe MMT, whatever the case may be. It might, like, we need to see this resolve first.
Yeah, right.
And so the reflation trade probably peters out at 175, 2% on the 10-year. Probably end up being a great buying opportunity. We'll see. For those that like bonds and long duration. And the rest will, you know, the rest we'll see as it comes.
Yeah, this is a great chart, man. This is one that everyone needs to save.
Yeah.
Yeah, like always, buddy. Great, great talking to you. Incredible insights. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go to check that out?
Yeah, no, so listen, as you know, I've been in the industry for over 20 plus years. Currently on my own, you know, been a strategist for that whole time period for the most part. You know, I've been in the since we last spoke, I've been building out a book of business and trying to you know, get more institutional type clients with me, but I'm also pretty active for those that are wanting to learn more. I do think I'm a big believer, the more you give, the more you get. And I have been sharing my knowledge to the extent that I can on Twitter through the handle @BondStrategist. And I have the website, thebondstrategist.com. I'm also working closely with a dear friend of ours, Danielle DiMartino Booth, which I've known her for over a decade as well. And her and I have always compared notes over time. But as a special advisor for her business, I try to kind of connect some of these dots as well.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate your time, George. I can't wait to do it again, buddy.
You too. Thanks, George. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.